This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look at the top stories in the coming week from our Daybreak anchors all around the world. Straight ahead on the program, global leaders gather to discuss the world's biggest issues. I'm Bob Moon in New York. I'll have that story.
I'm Nathan Hager in Washington, where Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation could hinge on one hearing this week.
And I'm Marcus Carlson in London, where we look to Italy's next budget. Will the promises of bold spending scare off investors?
I'm Danielle Bokov in Toronto. Oil producers from OPEC and its partners, including Russia, are meeting in Algiers this weekend to discuss whether to stick to their promise to hike output. The pressure from the U.S. has been intense.
And in Asia, we'll take a look at key central bank meetings as they dance with the Fed. I'm Brian Curtis in Hong Kong with that story coming up.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak on Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 99.1 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Good day to you. I'm Bob Moon. We begin today's program with a look at Wednesday's Federal Reserve meeting. And joining us with more on that is Carl Riccadonna, Chief U.S. Economist for Bloomberg Economics, and Gina Smilek, our Bloomberg News reporter, covering the Fed and the U.S. economy. Carl, let me start with you. We all know what's going to happen on Wednesday. We can just go home now, right?
If it's only the Fed funds rate you're looking at, then yes, we know what's happening. But if you've got an eye to the futures market, then there is some uncertainty as to what we'll be seeing.
So what do we need to be paying attention to?
So what we need to be paying attention to is not that September rate hike, but rather guidance towards future activity. And so that will involve an update of the Fed summary of economic projections, so economic forecasts and also financial forecasts, which of course include the famed dot plot. And so markets are leaning towards a December rate hike at this point. The Fed has the opportunity to put the nail in the coffin, so to speak. If all of the dots or all of the dots that we know are relevant for the December meeting now shift towards a high degree, a tight clustering of certainty that the Fed will move in December, then it's going to be a done deal. However, given that we heard a little bit of dovishness from Jay Powell when he spoke at the Jackson Hole Symposium, I have to wonder if the Fed might not see some advantage in maintaining some optionality around that December rate increase. Why have it done and dusted now when there's so much uncertainty about midterm elections, political risk, emerging market developments, and even some moderation in the inflation data that we've seen in the economy, which we'll get another data point later on this week, but it might show inflation just slipping back from the Fed's objective. So 2% inflation, we're not quite there yet.
Gina, have we heard any sense of consensus from the Fed speak we've been hearing about what direction they're going?
Yeah, well, I think we have heard some consensus in the sense that they're clearly still on board with this gradual tightening, at least until we get to neutral interest rates, which would be somewhere in mid-2019 based on their current dot plot. But I think the big uncertainty that remains, and one thing that Jay Powell could answer during his press conference next week, is how they're going to incorporate any new information coming in on the tariff front when they're thinking about this December rate hike. So is this the sort of thing that could derail them, or is this the kind of thing that they're just going to look through? In the past, we've kind of heard indications that they can basically look through these trade concerns, but that's sort of hinged on this idea that none of it's showing up in the data yet. Now we're talking about an escalation, and so I think that it opens the question, you know, would this be the kind of thing that would keep you on pause in December?
So up to now, it seemed almost inexorable, and now we're seeing a few cracks, huh?
I think so. And I'm curious to hear Carl's perspective on this, because what I think is really interesting is what happens if we see a clustering around December, like you mentioned, but then for whatever reason, we see Jay Powell coming out and saying, you know, one uncertainty that we have our eye on is this sort of trade situation, and that's a thing we'll be assessing as we go into December. How does the market interpret that?
Well, it depends if his dot moves up to the December range. Now, of course, we don't have an identification for each of the dots, but we have a pretty good guess based on the tone of recent policy remarks and whatnot. So we know there are two notorious doves on the committee who will likely be opposed to a December rate increase. So you'll see two dots not up where the cluster will be at year end. But if we only see two dots off the mark, then that means Jay Powell has really given in to the inclination to raise rates a fourth time this year, which certainly is still gradual. But as we get closer and closer to neutral, And again, we don't know exactly where neutral is, so we could easily blow by it without realizing it. It's going to be very important for the Fed to move cautiously towards that. And I think that certainly the economy is on good footing here, but we are starting to see, again, you mentioned signs of cracks in the facade. The inflation numbers have been coming in on the soft side. The last CPI report was below expectations, and it rounded to 0.1 on the core, but it was a weak 0.1 if we look at the unrounded estimates, and I think we're going to see a little bit of an inflation soft patch in the latter half of the year.
Gina, if the Fed should pull back, what would that mean, your best guess, to the economy and to the markets?
You know, I think it's an interesting question, and I think it all hinges on what that pullback looks like. So there are a couple of different ways the Fed could do that. They could take a legitimate pause in which they wait several months or several quarters before going again. That would potentially allow the economy to run a little bit hotter. I think they could also just sort of give a month or two pause to see how the trade situation plays out, in which case it's going to have a really negligible impact for the economy, maybe something slightly larger for markets. But I think that one thing to keep in mind when you're thinking about what any pause in December, if one would materialize, might look like, is that the Fed is about to go to every meeting press conferences starting next year. That's important because that effectively makes every meeting a live meeting, in theory at least. And that means that any pause doesn't necessarily have to be as long as it would have been earlier in the cycle.
Our thanks to Bloomberg Fed and economics reporter Gina Smilek and Bloomberg Economics chief U.S. economist Carl Riccadonna. And coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, central banks in Asia get a chance to respond to the Fed's decision. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. Up later in our program, the controversy continues around Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. But first, central banks in Asia are due out with policy decisions this week. For more on that, we turn to Bloomberg Daybreak Asia anchors Brian Curtis and Doug Christner.
Bob? Yes, a number of central banks will be in play, with the Philippines, Indonesia, Taiwan, and New Zealand all moving on policy. Now, the Philippine Central Bank has already signaled a fourth rate hike this year. Policymakers are looking at efforts to rein in inflation, which is at a decade high, and also to support the currency. So Doug and I thought we'd reach out to Enda Curran, Bloomberg's chief Asia economics correspondent. So Enda, the central banks are in kind of different conditions. Philippines and Indonesia are in a lot more difficult shape, and they're pulling out all the stops with higher rates, with interest rate swaps and other hedging tools. How well is that working?
Well, it's true that the conditions do vary economy by economy, Brian. There's no doubt about it. But ultimately, there is a common thread in all of this, and that is that emerging markets more generally are under pressure. Interest rates are going up. Don't forget, we will have the Federal Reserve expected to raise rates next week. That will pressure Asia and pressure central banks, in particular Indonesia, to respond because of the gap in interest rates as investors withdraw. Philippines have some issues on the inflation front, but also it plays into the emerging market story.
So I'm curious as to at what point this becomes political for these countries involved, whether or not they really jeopardize a growth rate accelerating if they're basically tightening credit.
Well, it's stability at a cost, absolutely. One thing all of these authorities want to make sure doesn't happen is that inflation gets out of control. And that's why in the Philippines, for example, they really are having to move aggressively now to get to stamp down on the price action there. Indonesia is a little bit more complicated because growth is doing okay. And the macro fundamentals are broadly okay, but they are jacking up interest rates that will cause pain 6 months down the road, and next year is an election year in Indonesia. So by all accounts, there aren't too many political leaders in the world, I think, would like to go into an election campaign with a very aggressive monetary tightening cycle behind them.
If we look at equities, a lot of pressure in Indonesia and the Philippines, something like 15 to 20% down. Taiwan, though, is flat, and New Zealand is actually higher by 11% in local currency terms and 4% in U.S. dollar terms. So how much pressure are companies coming under already because of the higher rates?
Well, there's no doubt that their international borrowing costs are going up. If you hold a U.S. dollar loan or if you hold U.S. dollar bonds, the cost of refinancing that will be more expensive. But I think for the likes of Taiwan, it's more about what happens in the coming months. It won't be just an interest rate story. There will also be the trade war story. There's an expectation that as the US and China go down that more protracted route with the dispute that's going on, that will hurt those countries in the supply chain, such as Taiwan.
Can you remember a time in recent history where there's been such fiscal and monetary threats on some of these emerging market countries in Asia at the same time?
At the same time as a trade war. And let's not forget oil prices are in the mix too. They're reasonably high. Obviously, that's a double-edged sword, depending if you import or export energy. But nonetheless, on paper, there are a lot of factors coming together that could pose potential headwinds for classic emerging economies in Asia. But people point to the underlying fundamentals remain somewhat resilient. Growth is okay. Inflation remains broadly subdued. They have built up their international reserves. In many cases, they have floating exchange rates. These are all things that they didn't have 20 years ago during the Asia crisis, for example. So for sure, there is a case to be made for the prosecution that all of these emerging markets are in for a whack. But just as you make that, others will point the other way too.
Anda, thanks very much. And we'll have a special coverage of those central bank meetings coming up here on Daybreak Asia. That is Bloomberg's chief Asia economics correspondent, Anda Curran. I'm Doug Krisner, along with Brian Curtis in Hong Kong. You can catch us every weekday here for Bloomberg Daybreak Asia, beginning at 6 a.m. in Hong Kong, 6 p.m. on Wall Street. Bob?
Doug and Brian, thank you. Now let's head to Europe, where budget season kicks off this week. Bond traders will be watching for fiscal plans from the likes of Italy and France. Joining us now with details is Bloomberg Daybreak Europe anchor Marcus Carlson.
Bob, the French budget comes Monday, but it's Italy that may attract the most scrutiny in the coming week. The populist coalition that rose to power earlier this year has promised potentially costly reforms, and concerns the budget deficit will shoot higher has sparked investor angst, with Italian borrowing costs ebbing and flowing accordingly. For more on what we can expect when Italy unveils its fiscal and growth targets, we've got John Fullane on the line, Italian government reporter, and here in London, we've got Paul Dobson, European market managing editor. John, let's kick it off with you. The Five Star Movement and the League, they've pledged a revolutionary program that includes both a basic income for citizens while also lowering the tax burden. How far are they ready to push it?
As far as they can, and they're getting pushback from the finance minister, who's more mainstream than they are. So we're getting a constant daily barrage of pressure from mainly Five Star, and that's with the citizens' income for the poor. But you've also got the League in the background, which wants tax breaks and also to roll back pension reform. And the finance ministry is just saying, well, look, you know, we don't have enough money in the kitty.
Now, you mentioned the Five Star Movement there. Its leader, Luigi Di Maio, says that the government should let the budget deficit rise above the 2% level. How strained would you say that relations are within the government? Because you also mentioned the finance minister, Tria. He's often being billed as the adult in the room.
That's right. Well, look, they're strained between Five Star and the League. You've got the Prime Minister Conte, who has no previous political experience, a law professor from Florence, who's piggy in the middle. And there's also conflict focusing on the finance minister because both Di Maio and Salvini are desperate for something to show their electorates before the European Parliament elections in May next year.
Paul, if we turn to you then, give us a sense of how closely this will be watched by markets. Would a deficit near or above the 3% level spook bond investors?
Yeah, absolutely. I've got a story in front of me here that we wrote at the end of last month at Marcus, where there's a quote, the kicker quote, and it's really telling. It's from NatWest Markets head of European rate strategy, Giles Gale. And he says, trading Italian bonds boils down to one number, the deficit projection for 2019 that the government decides to shoot for. And we surveyed analysts and we asked them, you know, what could happen if the deficit limit goes up to 3% of GDP? And the analysts came back to us and they said that the spread, the yield difference that investors demand to hold Italian bonds rather than safer German bonds could blow all the way out to 470 basis points from levels of only about 240 basis points this week. You know, on the other hand, if it comes in lower, if there's an agreement and everything's all right, then, you know, there could be more of a reward from investors. That spread could come back towards the 200 basis points mark or even tighter.
All right. It's all about the messaging, it seems then. Paul Dobson, European Markets Managing Editor, thank you. And also our thanks to Italian government reporter John Fullane, who was with us down the
line. I'm Marcus Carlson in London. You can catch us every weekday morning here for Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, beginning at 6 a.m. in London and 1 a.m. on Wall Street. Bob.
Thanks, Marcus. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, the biggest stories for the week ahead in Washington. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting live to New York, Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 99.1. To Boston, Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Daybreak.
I'm Bob Moon in New York with your global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. Coming up later in our program, global leaders gather to discuss the world's biggest issues. But first, we head to our Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington to see what items in politics and government are set to top the agenda next week. And for that, we bring in Nathan Hager, host of our Politics, Policy, Power, and Law program, heard weekdays at noon on Bloomberg Radio. Nathan?
Well, Bob, the upcoming week could be pivotal in the confirmation process for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. The Senate Judiciary Committee planning a hearing into Professor Christine Blasey Ford's accusation that the judge sexually assaulted her when they were in high school. And President Trump seemed to understand the stakes when he mentioned his nominee at a rally in Las Vegas this week, but didn't mention the accuser by name.
And I'm not saying anything about anybody else, but I want to tell you that Brett Kavanaugh is one of the finest human beings you will ever have the privilege of knowing or meeting.
Bloomberg News Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gordon is here with me now. And of course, since that rally, Craig, Trump, as he often does, has saved his ire for Twitter. So what does that do now?
I mean, look, this is obviously already a highly fraught situation where you have a person in line for a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court, an accuser coming forward with a fairly graphic allegation of what, you know, she says he did to her back when they were in high school. So it's already very, you know, very emotionally fraught. Donald Trump has actually been pretty restrained in his tweets. He had said, while defending Kavanaugh, saying he thought he was a good man and deserved to be on the bench, you know, said that the accuser, Professor Ford, should be heard. All that sort of changed when he started to tweet about how, well, if the attack was as bad as she said, why didn't she file a police report? And I want to see the police report. We, as far as we know, there is no police report. She or her parents didn't file a police report at the time. So really, Trump wading in a way that is highly uncomfortable for Senate Judiciary Republicans, who had been worried about almost exactly this, that Trump would send a very inflammatory tweet that would take the already high temperature up even higher.
Yeah, because even as Republicans have sort of criticized how Democrats have handled the accusation from Dr. Ford, they have been trying to play a very sensitive line here and say, yeah, we do want to hear from her.
Yeah, I mean, look, everybody knows where everybody stands on this. Chuck Grassley, the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, wants Brett Kavanaugh to be on the Supreme Court in a lifetime appointment. So does Donald Trump. So do the Republicans on that committee. But I think they have recognized that she has brought forth at least a credible allegation. They have, you know, agreed essentially with her contention that if she would like to speak, that she deserves to be heard. And they do seem to be trying to find a way to allow her to testify before the full committee and again, give her side of the story. Brett Kavanaugh has already said, essentially, I'll show up anytime, any place. He's denied this vigorously, repeatedly. And, you know, we would hear from him as well. So you're setting up the potential of an unbelievably dramatic, you know, I guess the word is showdown between these two pivotal characters. Now, people have been open to hearing that on both sides. Trump seems to have made that a little more difficult.
The other big event this week happening in New York is President Trump heads to his second UN General Assembly meeting.
That's right. And, you know, you might imagine that a UN General Assembly isn't exactly Donald Trump's favorite place in the world. It's a lot about diplomacy and globalism and all those things that are not exactly Trump's cup of tea. But we will be hearing from him several times. He, of course, traditionally, there's any of the leaders who show up are allowed to give a speech. He'll be giving a speech on Tuesday. And then Trump himself will actually chair a UN Security Council meeting on Wednesday, which will be about the non-proliferation of nuclear weapons, which is sort of code for Iran. The United States wanted the Security Council meeting to be about Iran, but realized they would have to invite the Iranian leader Rouhani if that were the case. So they sort of fuzzed up the topic of the meeting down to non-proliferation. But you still could have a situation where Trump, Iranians kind of squaring off on that topic.
Yeah, and even on his Twitter feed this past week, President Trump said he will be chairing a meeting at the Security Council on Iran. Could that change things?
It just might. I think, you know, the UN is the United Nations is known as a place where they follow the rules pretty strictly. And I believe if the Iranian leader has the right to be there, the United Nations will enforce that. And you could have a pretty dramatic, you know, showdown between Trump and Rouhani. The interesting thing about that meeting to me is that you could almost have an interesting showdown between Trump and any of U.S. allies that are there. As we know, Trump pulled out of the Iranian nuclear deal. The allies, France, the UK, do not want to pull out. And so he could be kind of lonely in that room there if it ends up becoming a hearing about Iran. But anytime you got Donald Trump and the United Nations, well, we'll let the sparks fly.
Busy, busy as always. Thank you, Craig.
Yep.
Bloomberg News, Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gordon. And that is what's happening in the nation's capital. I'm Nathan Hager. Catch me every weekday on Bloomberg Politics, Policy, Power, and Law. It airs at noon Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio. Bob.
Thanks, Nathan. We'll be watching it all closely in the coming week. Straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, global leaders gather to discuss the world's biggest issues. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. Coming up, news we're watching in markets for the week ahead. But first, global leaders gather this Wednesday in New York to discuss the world's biggest issues. It's the annual Bloomberg Global Business Forum, and Bloomberg New York Bureau Chief Jason Kelly joins us now to preview the event. Welcome, Jason. This event is dedicated to convening the most important global leaders from public and private sectors. I know it's going to be impossible to list them all here, but give us a sense of what kind of names have been lined up here.
So it's heads of state, it's CEOs, and from a heads of state perspective, we're talking about Theresa May, obviously the Prime Minister of the UK, very much in the news lately, should say, the President of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa, and a number of others on the political or the governmental side. But we're also going to hear from Robin Lee, the CEO of Baidu. We're going to hear from Jim Hackett, the CEO of Ford as well. So a lot of conversations and really meant to come up with some solutions for a pretty complicated world. Mm-hmm.
This event takes place alongside the 73rd session of the United Nations General Assembly that we've been talking about. And the Bloomberg Forum is focused on strengthening global trade and economic alliances. I would imagine that means the topics are going to include things like isolationism and the T word, tariffs.
Absolutely. Tariffs and trade certainly will be very much front of mind because that is really touching all countries in a lot of ways and all companies in one way or another, whether it is directly or through their customers. And even when we think about Wall Street, this is Bloomberg after all, we are in New York and we're going to have a lot of big names there as well.
And you've got government and corporate leaders coming together to reach common goals of sustainable economic development. I hear in that echoes of the Paris Climate Accord.
Absolutely. Echoes of Paris. You know, we had a gathering similarly a couple weeks ago in San Francisco around the idea of action around climate. That is certainly top of mind. And, you know, people like Al Gore said to us a couple weeks ago that, you know, this has to be something that is investable and actionable on the part of businesses.
And we have seen progress on the part of business cooperating with government to go ahead and accomplish these goals, like even in the U.S., where President Donald Trump has sort of pulled us away from the climate accord.
That's absolutely true. And I think what we hear from corporate leaders is they are not only willing to, but feel it necessary to push forward with all of those goals for their own bottom lines.
Okay, so this is the second annual Bloomberg
Global Business Forum.
Global Business Forum. What are we talking about here in terms of how people can hear what's going on?
Well, one of the most exciting things that's happening this year is that Bloomberg Television and Radio will be broadcasting segments. I'll be live on site there during the day for Bloomberg Business Week. We'll also be emanating a lot of broadcasts there. But we're also very excited about a couple of panels that will feature some of those big Wall Street names, Larry Fink, David Solomon, Tijan Tiem from Credit Suisse, as well as Jim Coulter from TPG, you know, really digging into what the future of finance is. So that's something you'll definitely want to tune in for.
Bloomberg's New York bureau chief and co-host of the Bloomberg Business Week radio program, Jason Kelly. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you, Bob.
And we'll bring you live coverage again of this year's Bloomberg Global Business Forum this Wednesday on both Bloomberg Radio and Television. Let's turn our attention to markets for the week ahead now. For that, we bring in Bloomberg Radio Stocks editor Dave Wilson and Bloomberg Cross Asset reporter Sarah Poncik. Welcome to you both. Dave, let me start with you. The big rearrangement of the GICS takes effect on Monday. That is the Global Industry Classification System. And beyond that, you're going to have to explain it to me.
Okay, we're talking about the 11 main industry groups in the S&P 500 for starters. As of Monday, telecommunications will become a history group, you might put it that way. And it'll be combined with internet companies like Facebook and Google's parent Alphabet and also Netflix, so three of the four FANG stocks, into this broader category called communication services, which is also going to include the likes of Walt Disney and Comcast and Fox. You know, they'll be pulled out of different areas of the market, you know, as it's defined or has been defined historically. And so you're bringing all these media companies together, whether you're talking the old media of television or the new media of the internet. And phone companies kind of fit in. Think about AT&T owning DirecTV and owning Time Warner. So, I mean, there's a certain logic to what S&P is doing. That said, it's going to be a real change because, you know, you think about phone companies historically. If you're an investor, you buy them for their dividends. It's a relatively steady growth industry, and now it's going to be a whole different story.
So, Sarah, are we going to see a reshuffling of investor money then?
I mean, we are actually already seeing it. So we also have to think of the exchange-traded funds that track these different indices. So they are going about it different ways. Vanguard actually changed back in May. We have seen money already going into XLC, which is their ETF version of the communication sector. State Street will also be making changes. However, iShares is going to stick with the old sector classification. So people are going to have to make sure that if you are buying ETFs, you are looking at what is actually in the funds because they will be different. But we have seen this week a lot of money going into that newer Vanguard Communications ETF. So we already see people starting to switch around their holdings. They want to make sure that they are holding these names that will be going over. They like the new communication sector. I spoke to a couple investors. One actually said that he added it back in June. He wanted to get ahead of all the craziness, ahead of all the changes, and he bought XLC up in June.
Let's turn to earnings now. And David, I'd like you to focus on perhaps the most interesting on the list, given recent developments. Nike, this is the company that unveiled this controversial ad campaign with Colin Kaepernick, who started the Take a Knee protest for the NFL. Since then, the stock has sort of sprinted, if you will.
Well, and the results are there to show it. And that's presumably what we're going to get out of the report from Nike. Analysts anticipating that earnings are going to increase. And that's after 2 years of declines in that first quarter. Looking at revenue, analysts looking for a 10% increase. That's after 13% in their fiscal fourth quarter. So sustained growth as far as that goes. And so far, it looks like the building this ad campaign around Colin Kaepernick is paying off for the company. So, you know, how that plays out and what's ahead for Nike, that's going to be a real focus when we get their results.
Sarah, any other earnings you're going to have an eye on this week?
We're also going to hear from Rite Aid and ConAgra this week. So Rite Aid, they had a proposed merger going on with Albertsons, and that was called off. So many analysts are saying that now Rite Aid is really going to have to show that they can really stand alone. Now Rite Aid is down about 35% this year. It was down 76% last year. So investors are going to want to see that they can turn it around.
And ConAgra, a lot of different brand names.
Yes, a lot of different brand names. So we have Ready Whip, Orville Redenbacher's, P.F. Chang's, kind of spans the gamut. There is going to be interest on how the acquisition of Pinnacle Foods is playing out. We had that before the last earnings, but still seeing if there's any more there. Also, analysts are expecting sales to have risen in the single to low digits. They're saying that added gains in grocery and snacks and also refrigeration could be really helping them out there.
Bloomberg cross-asset reporters Sarah Poncik and Bloomberg Stocks editor Dave Wilson, thanks to you both. Let's head to the commodity space for the week ahead now, where we are focusing on oil. For that, we bring in Bloomberg's Danielle Bukov in Toronto. Good day to you, Danielle.
Bob, since OPEC and its non-OPEC allies met in June, a lot has changed, including in the last week, a ramp up in the trade war, including another $200 billion in American tariffs against China, plus an emerging market crisis that started with Turkey. Bloomberg's James Herron joins me from London with a look at what all of this may mean for oil prices. The biggest question out of this meeting, obviously, is whether or not OPEC and its allies are going to stick to their plan to hike output to contain oil prices. Which way does it look like the wind is blowing?
Well, the case for an output increase is that two OPEC members, Venezuela and Iran, are losing a lot of oil production at the moment. Venezuela's economy is in meltdown, and Iran has just been hit by U.S. sanctions that are really taking a lot of oil off the market, too. The case against is about the uncertainty in the global economy. Growth could be slowing, Trump's Chinese tariffs, and the emerging market crisis. Bloomberg spoke to Ed Morse, head of commodities at Citigroup, and here's what he had to say about it.
We reckon that a bad ending for the Chinese trade squabbles with the U.S. and the Chinese growth picture could actually shave as much as a half a percentage off of global GDP growth next year. Not 0.1%, but 0.5%. And that would inevitably have a significant multiple 100,000-barrel-a-day impact on demand growth.
The irony here is that as Trump's tariffs make a production increase less likely, his tweets are pressuring for the opposite. He targeted OPEC again today on Twitter, pushing it to boost output, blaming it for high prices.
Yeah, you talk about that lack of clarity from the U.S. administration. Meanwhile, that temporary alliance between OPEC and non-OPEC members is itself not exactly united. How does the Saudi-Russia standoff with Iran fit into all of this?
Well, Iran is protesting very strongly, saying that Saudi Arabia and Russia do not have the right to increase production. It's a violation of their agreement. The reality is that Iran is very isolated, both within OPEC and internationally because of the sanctions. So it has very little power to stop other producers pumping more oil.
A lot of power coming from the U.S., though, as you mentioned. If we go back to that idea of the U.S. pressuring Saudi Arabia in particular to contain oil prices, how is that likely to shape out?
Well, the last time this happened in early summer, the Saudis buckled to the pressure from Trump, and they ended up promising to add an extra million barrels a day to the oil market. And now the meeting this weekend will really determine whether they'll actually follow through on that pledge.
James, thank you very much. That's what we're watching this week in Commodities in Toronto. I'm Danielle Bokov.
Thanks, Danielle. That does it for this edition of Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend. Join us again Monday morning at 5 a.m. Wall Street time for the latest on markets overseas and the news you need to start your day. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.